It's Saturday, July 20th, 2013. We're broadcasting live from Santa Cruz in the central coast of California. This is KOSP Public Radio 88.9 and KOSP.org. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KOSP. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. With me in the studio today is Bonnie Jean Primsch. Bonnie Jean Primsch, sorry about that. Broadcaster at large and mediator. Hi, Bonnie.
Why, howdy. If you want, I could just sing that, you know, we're through being cool, if you want.
No, I'm good.
Okay.
That would be pretty fun.
All right.
We also have Lindsay Lonnie, systems analyst and support engineer and software engineer. Hi.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning. It's been a while. It's so nice to see you back.
Thank you.
Welcome
it's good
back.
To be back.
Yeah.
And I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm a programmer, photographer, and sometimes I host radio shows.
Yes, like today.
Yes. So I think I shall.
What's going on?
Well, you know, the biggest thing in the news is the PRISM stuff. And It's still big. We covered a lot, and we got a few stories about it. Lindsay's got some research on it. And I thought I'd ask you to tell us a little bit about what the EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, is doing. Now, we've had them on the show. We've had premiere mm-hmm. episodes. And I will link that episode we had most recently with one of their employees.
Right.
The Electronic Frontier Foundation is this awesome organization that looks at the frontier of electronic life that we have mm-hmm. and thinks about human and social rights in that space. They are, have a lot of lawyers involved, and basically they're kind of giving you recommendations, political recommendations in this space. It's a wonderful organization to follow, and I pay attention. Whenever some story comes up about trying to influence Congress in a certain bill or whatever, I'll go read the EFF's opinion about it, and it's normally a pretty educated opinion and kind of in line with what
I think.
Can
you just summarize their basic stances? Are they privacy rights? Are they keeping everything free and open? What's their deal?
I would say that they like transparency, and they definitely like civil liberties, and look at the technical ramifications and how that affects civil liberties.
Okay.
So you can kind of think of it as, what's the civil liberties organization?
Like NAACP or
yeah,
ACLU?
Like ACLU, but for electronic topic points. And mm-hmm. and it's tricky because the electronic topic points, without really understanding the technology, it's hard to assess what's going on in that space.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is kind of a complicated thing. It's something so we cover that a lot because it's one of those things we can explain really well on Geek Speak. So.
And so it's nice to have an organization that's looking at these things in detail because they're hard to parse just by kind of glancing at them in a casual way.
That's right.
So what's been going on?
Well, on the behalf of a bunch of organizations, I mean, as you can imagine, there's a ton of lawsuits happening right now that are related to this PRISM thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is this one that the EFF is doing on behalf of certain rights activists, church leaders, drug and gun rights activists. It's a blanket thing. I'm just going to read you a quote from it to give you an idea of what they're saying in this lawsuit.
Okay.
The First Amendment protects the freedom to associate and express political views as a group, but the NSA's mass untargeted collection of Americans' phone records violates that right by giving the government a dramatically detailed picture into our associated ties. Who we call, how often we call them, how long we speak, shows the government what groups we belong to or associate with, which political issues concern us, our religious affiliation. So exposing this information, especially in a massive, untargeted way over a long period of time, violates the Constitution and the basic First Amendment tests that have been in place for over 50 years. So that's their stance on that.
Mm-hmm.
And
the EFF's stance on it.
Right,
yeah.
The EFF stance on behalf of these other organizations. You were just talking about the ACLU, and last month the ACLU filed a similar lawsuit in a federal court in New York asking the government to stop phone tracking programs.
Mm-hmm.
And as of this week, the New Jersey Supreme Court ordered that the police will now have to get a search warrant before obtaining tracking information. So they actually...
So even the meta information, the track information itself will
right.
have to do a court order.
Is that exactly. just in New Jersey, though?
Right. So now it's just in New Jersey, but there's different... They're basically starting these lawsuits all over the country because
mm-hmm.
they're expecting that eventually it's going to end up in the Supreme Court. And so
right.
they want to have a lot of
building
different
cases.
Right, building cases. One of the other things that came out of this week is that Yahoo won a request to unseal some 2008 case records where they sued to protect their users' rights.
Mm.
They were requested to turn over information. They refused and they went to court saying that they shouldn't have to do it, but they lost and had to turn over the records, but the records were sealed for NSA saying that it was a security issue to unseal the records. So now they're unsealing those records, but the NSA has the ability to review review the records first and mm-hmm. see what gets released to the public in the public version of that, in case there's something that's a security, national security issue.
So even though they are the company's records, it's the NSA that gets to decide what gets out to the public and what does not.
Yeah. And there's lots of other legislation going on right now about cell phone location tracking. That seems to be one of the things they're targeting. Mm-hmm. So I'll put up a link that lists all the different, you know, lawsuits and who's doing it. Maine is another one that has a similar one to New York happening right now, and I think Washington.
Yeah, everything we talk about today, we'll have links up on geekspeak.org to find out more about it. So there's a bit of a backlash in the tech community for the U.S. government doing the cybersecurity espionage kind of stuff. There's this famous hacker convention. I think it's been called a hacker convention called DEF CON. You've heard of DEF CON, right,
I've
Lindsay?
Been there a few times.
Oh, you have been. I've never been. So you're much.
It's great. The EFF has a booth there where people can get their heads shaved into Mohawks, and they donate money to get their heads shaved into Mohawks.
Oh, cool.
You get to watch them. They show videos. It's just kind of a...
You didn't do that.
I thought about it. Yeah. I did think about it, but
so
I haven't done it.
So this hacker conference... The organization that just that represents it just said that released a little a statement. Mm-hmm. So here's their statement. For over two decades, DEF CON has been an open nexus of hacker culture, a place where seasoned pros, hackers, academic, and feds can meet, share ideas, and party on the and partly on. On neutral territory.
They can party on neutral territory.
They can party. That's what it says.
Yes.
That's what it says. Our community operates.
If you consider Las Vegas neutral.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the DEF CON organizers all said, our community operates in the spirit of openness, verified trust, and mutual respect. When it comes to sharing and socializing with feds, recent revelations have made many in the community uncomfortable about this relationship. Therefore, I think it would be best for everyone involved if the feds call a timeout and not attend DEF CON this year.
Yeah, they're uninviting the feds.
They're uninviting the feds.
Ooh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
It's kind of a big deal. I mean, the thing is, the keynote last year at DEF CON was NSA director of general director. Keith Alexander. He was the keynote address at DEF CON. I mean, the government is very involved in this conversation. And one of the reasons, of course, is that when you pull a lot of like-minded people around security and this kind of detailed encryption security environment where everybody's really knowledgeable, it's the perfect place to recruit people, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So everybody that's in that space wants to be there and have booths. And it's a really fun show to go to if you're into that space. I'm not as much as Lindsay, obviously. But what I find fascinating is that the exclusion of them. Now,
are they really going to be excluded? No. They're just going to go like, all right, we're just going to slip people in without saying we're feds.
You know, they can go and just
that's
not say who they are, right? And that's not a big deal. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be a little bit more difficult because people have to spend their own money or get reimbursed differently or something like that. But, of course, they'll still be able to go. But it is a, you know, it's being covered in the press, obviously. Yeah. We're talking about it, media. And, you know, the point is really about the hacker community, which is... you know, a lot of the people that are in that space, involved in that space, are kind of in it because of there's like a social responsibility. If you can figure something out, to share it. There's a lot of like, hey, I figured out this bug in this software. I contacted the company. They didn't do anything for months. Somebody could exploit this, so I'm going to publicly state it. Right? There's like this kind of this public responsibility concept that's embedded in a lot of the geeks that are at this conference.
It's like a greater good kind of looking out for.
And so this is basically kind of taking that and summarizing it into a statement saying what you're doing is wrong, which is interesting to see the hackers do that, you know.
But I don't think it'll really serve as a DEF CON this year as a place where the hacker community can get together and say, okay, what do we want to do about this? Because it's not going to be a private conversation.
No, it never. I mean, and that's, well, we're learning that there is no such thing as a private conversation.
There's no such thing as a private conversation.
And that's the whole thing about the PRISM stuff is that it's, as this comes out, it's so clear. Like last week, I kind of talked about how even with really, really good security, like private public key security, there's actually still gaping abilities for government to find out what the data is. Mm-hmm. And that's just about, you know.
Go ahead. I have some things that address specifically what you were
talking
about.
I kind of knew that. I was trying to lead into that. So go for it. So,
way to make a segue happen, Lyle.
Yeah. Right? It's like magic. One of them is that you were talking about how people introduce bugs there. I shouldn't say introduce bugs there. It's a misnomer. But they announce the bugs they discovered after they notify the company. Mm-hmm. So the idea is not to just surprise companies
and have
people exploiting them and things like that. They make sure that the companies know well ahead of time. So Google had a bug they call the Master Key Patch app for the Android phones. And basically a vulnerability exists in the code base that would allow a hacker to modify a legitimate digitally signed Android app APK file and not break the cryptographic signature.
Oh, that's not good.
So normally,
can I parse that a little bit for Bonnie?
Yes, please.
Okay. Yeah, because I didn't.
So the APK file is a package of an application that you would run on an Android phone. You can also run it on my Google Glass, for example.
For instance.
That I'm wearing right now. Yeah.
That's so cool.
No. I think you don't understand that word. So,
I don't. It means something else.
This basically is an executable package, right? It's the way you share applications on Android devices.
Okay. It makes them go.
Yeah. And there's similar types of packages in all environments. And the idea of a cryptographically signed package is if I trust, like, let's say, Google or Apple or something, and I get an application and I want to know if I can run it on, I can look at the signature and say, it's signed by somebody I trust, and therefore they've looked at it for me, and since I trust them, I know it's good to run.
Okay.
And so what this story is, actually, you can get the signature to be valid, you can modify the package, meaning change the application completely, and then the signature's still valid. That's the problem. That's a major problem
Oh, I see. Because then you don't necessarily know if anyone's looked at it or not.
That's right. So major flaw in the packaging of Android apps.
Yeah. And it only affects certain versions of phones, et cetera, et cetera. And Google was made aware of it and immediately released a patch. But the problem is that our cell phone vendors don't often release firmware updates.
Right.
And so it's really hard for vendors to be releasing those things, and they don't have a lot of accountability. There's nobody really to hold them accountable other than the public.
Well, that seems like a really big flaw. I mean, I think it wouldn't be true that a lot of people are primarily using their cell phone for all this stuff anyway, rather than
The thing that's so disturbing about this kind of thing is that the reason, the motivation for the telco not to, the cell phone carrier, not to release a patch to their users is that there's a small percentage chance every time you update something, small percentage chance for something to go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And if your phone goes wrong and you contact the company, that's one thing. But if the company releases an update and a lot of phones go wrong and the reason for it was their action, it's harder to justify that internally and for tech support reasons. So the companies, the telcos, just don't want to update patches. They don't care. And the thing is, who's really going to take advantage of it? Well, to take advantage of this, you have to build an app that then the person wants to put on their phone or send it to the phone. I mean, it becomes this kind of question of, is it dangerous or not? It's definitely a security vulnerability. But the thing that's so interesting in the light of like what the federal government is doing with the amount of investment in security vulnerability advantage taking that they're doing is that this is a clear example of how to get snooping software on a phone, right?
Yeah.
So the cell phone can be sent data whenever. And depending on how this vulnerability works, it's possible that you could install an app on a phone that's signed incorrectly that does snooping stuff. And the kind of company that would take advantage of that would be a government agency that has enough resources to do so.
Right.
So this is the kind of thing that leads into it, right?
Yeah.
No one's really going to take advantage except unless you have tons of resources and you want to collect as much data as possible. But who wants to do that?
Right.
So the vulnerability, the specific vulnerability that at DEF CON they'll talk more about is this package management of the Android device. Do you have more on that story? Did you want to?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Basically, Duo Security announced the availability of an Android utility called Rekey on Tuesday, and it allows Droid users to patch their own phones, essentially.
Sweet.
Okay. So they're going to announce that.
The hackers are on.
The hackers are on it. Our brothers and sisters are protecting us helping us.
Thanks.
And of course, only the geeks are going to use the tool.
Right.
Because it is kind of complicated to do that kind of thing.
But we're talking about it, so maybe people will go get Rekey.
You know, if you've got an Android phone, especially an older one, definitely keep it, and you care about your security and privacy. And that's the thing that's so difficult is, how much do you care about your security and privacy?
I guess 50-something percent of people are kind of okay.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's interesting, the social contracts and the way we work about our systems and lives. We all have locks on our doors, and the truth is we all have windows too. So it's really easy for your neighbor to break into your house. Like, they know when you're not home and they can do it.
Yeah.
But we have social contracts and norms that make it not something that's comfortable, right? And so we don't do that. And of
largely.
Course, a key is a little bit of an inconvenience, right? You got to have it, and then you're locked out, you don't have it. And there's all that kind of... it doesn't make it easy. And security is the same type of issue. You've got to decide. The problem with security, of course, is that there's no social norm. Everybody's trying to get your stuff all the time. So if you're not on top of it, you will be taken advantage of. And that's what we've learned with viruses on computers. That's why they exist.
Right. Yeah.
So in just a minute, we're going to talk a little bit more about a lot more news stories and such. In the later half of the show, we'll also call you. We'll ask you to call in with questions and comments about technology. We'll call you if you
we'll
email
call
us your
you.
Phone. So the phone number to call in a little while is 800-655-5877. Again, that's 800-655-5877. In the air room, I'm Lyle Troxell. We have Lindsay Lonnie and Bonnie Jean Primsch. Do stay with us.
And on the next 7th Avenue Project, 22 years of walking, 17 years of silence. For two decades, John Francis traveled America on foot while keeping a vow of silence. He describes what he learned about himself and his fellow humans, because now he's broken his vow of silence, on the next 7th Avenue Project, hosted by Robert Polly. That's tomorrow at noon on KUSP 88.9 or KUSP.org. It's Geek Speak here on KUSP.
And today's Geek Bit. Now, Geek Bit's something you have to see to believe, or should say, it's horrible content for the radio. Yes, we do it every week. And this week, this week it's Wi-Fi art. It's already up at geekspeak.org if you want to take a look at it. It's a little video. And this is, this group of artists made a 4-meter a light pole, a whole bunch of LEDs, really bright LEDs.
Okay.
And then they lit those LEDs based off of the Wi-Fi signal that they were receiving in the area they were walking in. Hmm. And then they opened the camera up for a long exposure at night in a town and walked with this pole along the streets. And it draws pictures like this. You two will see them because you're in the air room with me.
Oh, wow. That's pretty neat.
So the video that's linked is them doing this project. Really wonderful, beautiful thing. And it kind of shows how Wi-Fi signals vary. But also, it's neat to see lights being drawn. Lights are pretty.
And with long exposures too, also pretty.
Absolutely.
So it basically measures sort of how much Wi-Fi signal is coming through in any given spot.
Yeah, it's the strength. And I mean, if you get into the technical details, it becomes less technically interesting. As if all visualization data, there's a lot more there. There's only so much
you can convey.
Yeah, I mean, they're capturing one Wi-Fi point, I think. Mm-hmm. And there's actually in a city, there's hundreds of them. But also, you'll notice that in the video, you'll see them walk through the same area, and it varies a lot. So mm-hmm. whether it's that momentarily or how they're doing it, that's not important. What's really important is that we are surrounded by this very invisible but effective medium, right? Wi-Fi signals are, and just radio signals in general have been with us for decades.
So those with a concern about cell phone towers can either relax or really not relax.
Oh, but speaking of that, I found wonderful, I was talking with somebody at a party this week.
Yeah.
And okay, this is, I forgot about talking about this, but I really want to share it with everybody.
Okay.
So he is a cell phone engineer, mm-hmm. electrical engineer. Okay. And I'm not going to even bring up his name because he works at Apple and I don't want to give him trouble.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, he works at some big company. I don't want to give him trouble. Anyway, so what he shared with me is that cell phones have very strict regulations. There's strict regulations on how much RF, radio frequency energy, can be near the human body, which makes sense, right? We don't want to do anything that's bad for us.
I appreciate that. Yeah.
Now, cell phones do not have ionizing radiation, which means they can't actually throw electrons off of it. You can't modify molecular structures with these things. Therefore, they're not cancer dangerous, okay? That's the kind of definition that we've talked about this a lot
in the
past.
So I can go ahead and keep mine in my pocket.
You're fine. But the thing that's really interesting is that the regulations are not about that. The regulations are about power levels and keeping the power levels at a, quote, safe level. And to know what the safe level is, there's been tests and all that, but there's actually regulations on how strong it can be. At the same time, the cell phone power levels and the batteries can do a lot. In fact, they can overshoot that amount of power and make it outside of spec to be near your body. And they want to do that because they want to have good coverage.
Mm-hmm.
So the question is...
So it's the battle between safety versus coverage.
Right. So what the cell phone companies have been doing, and they've been doing this for a while, is putting sensors in the phone to detect a human body near them. If a human body's close, they will reduce their power level.
Hmm.
And I said, why don't they tell people? Because in my geek mind, I translated this to, wait, your phone is varying depending on how close it is to your body?
That's a good thing to know.
That's an important thing to know.
Yeah.
Strangely, we all know this. Because when we have a problem with a call... What do? You like take the phone, hold it by the bottom, and then you put it up in the air and you watch the Wi-Fi signal away from your head and you're looking at it. You know what I'm talking about?
Right.
Kind of look up to it. You can see this in bad cell phone areas. You hold it away from yourself.
And but the then reason, you talk, you put it back to
and
your
then
ear.
It stops working again. So if you want to have a better call experience, get it away from your body.
So that's why the Bluetooth.
Earbuds, Bluetooth, good idea.
All
yeah.
Right.
So the thing is, you're not really finding the magical spot of like where the Wi-Fi works above your head. It's just that it's away from your body.
What I've done is like hold it up. Oh, the signal's good there. And then went like move my body close to the thing.
Exactly. That's what we do, right? So if maybe, I don't know, the cell phone carriers could have just said, yeah, we detect your body and we reduce the quality of the call as it gets closer to your head. That's the reason they don't want to do it, right?
Yeah. No, but they'd sell Bluetooth. They'd sell other products.
And, you know, I use earbuds in my iPhone because I listen to a lot of podcasts. Yeah. That's how I talk on the phone. I almost always do that. In fact, every time I don't do that, especially at my home where the network's not very good, I have really bad calls. Mm. This is why. And then, of course, in my car, I regularly put my phone under my right, if I'm driving, under my right thigh. Uh-huh. And if I want to really make a call, I have to move it on the seat next to me or stick it above. Like, I normally stick it above me on the sun visor thing. And then at the next stop, it falls on my face and breaks my nose. So the point is that you don't need to put it up high. You just need to put it away from a large bag of mostly water.
Okay. Please keep away from large bags of mostly water. All right.
So you had another story to follow up on NSA stuff, right?
Yeah.
So,
just a note about, you had mentioned encryption and how there's not a great way to do encryption. RSA stuff is, pretty standard and everybody can use the algorithms. Mm-hmm. And so it's easy to intercept. One person posted about this and I was reading about it, and they were saying that the RSA's weakness is that it lets anyone with access to a copy of the server's private key decrypt anything. So once you have the key, you have access to everything.
Yeah.
But there's Diffie-Hellman. Have you heard of that?
I talked about this last week, actually. Or no, maybe I didn't talk about it, but yeah, go ahead.
I don't remember.
Do you want to explain Diffie-Hellman?
Well, I don't know that much about it.
Okay.
But it's a transport layer security, and Diffie-Hellman key exchange basically generates session keys in such a way that only the two parties involved in the communication can obtain the keys.
Right.
So after the session's complete, they destroy the session key. And so Google has been experimenting with encrypting its service. So if you use Google Drive, they encrypt the movement of the file, the transaction, the tunnel that it moves through.
Oh, I remember
through.
You saying this. Yeah. So that only the people involved know where the thing went. Someone looking from the outside wouldn't be able to tell that any activity has happened.
The default way that SSL works, or TLS really, the HTTPS protocol. There's a lot of acronyms, huh?
Yeah.
The one that makes the little green lock icon, the one you have to look for when you're at your bank, mm-hmm. that one. The way the default works is that there's a known private key by the website you're visiting, and then a shared public one, and you get the shared public one. It looks like it's signed, and then you initiate the first communication using that, and then you pass together a secret that you share. Okay, and the truth is that if you capture all that and later get that private key from the company, all of it's encryptable. And that's what probably the government's doing for a long time. And it'd be really relatively easy to say, hey, you're not even using this key anymore, so give it to us now, 3 years mm-hmm. later, and then mm-hmm. the data's all transparent. Yeah. So with this Diffie-Hellman type, which is actually part of this TLS spec, you can actually use different protocols. What it basically says is the initial communication to actually start and deal with this, we're going to come up with where only we know those keys and we never keep them. So it's during only this current session. So when you then finally...
As a protocol for any company to use?
Yeah, you could just use this by default.
Okay. It's supported by modern browsers.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
So what's going on? We're kind of using... We're using the knowledge that it is your bank you're talking to, uh-huh. that part of it, and the encryption is the same mm-hmm. in most of the patterns. Mm-hmm. That's not good. So what you want to do is you use that same public key, private key to assure that you're talking to the right people. Mm-hmm. And then once you've assured the authentication of that, you then do the encryption some other way. And then the encryption is never saved and known. So basically it would restrict this ability to de-encrypt later. And it sounds like Google's moving in that direction, which makes a lot of sense.
Well, we don't know. They haven't disclosed what they're going to use. But a lot of people are saying it would be pointless for them to use encryption because, you know, the things that people are concerned about is this RSA, you know, or the NSA reading your personal information, and mm-hmm. they can just request it. It doesn't matter if it's encrypted. They could still have access to it.
They can still request it.
But some people are more concerned that there are sniffers, that maybe they're gathering information without Google even knowing what's being gathered. Mm. And so if we're using this other algorithm, it would make it more difficult for them to gather your
It would at least take care of that.
To some degree, yeah.
To some degree.
Maybe.
Possibly.
Hopefully.
For a little while.
The Diffie-Hellman key exchange was published in 1976 by Martin Hellman and Whitefield Diffie. At the same time and totally separately, it was invented by some British signals intelligence group.
Well, so, the Diffie-Hellman encryption key exchange is the name of my next band.
It does sound like a band.
That's
name, doesn't
a fantastic
it?
Name for a band.
Hey, if you'd like to call in with questions and comments about technology, you're welcome to do so. The phone number is 1-800-655-5877. I'll give out that number again, slower, when I invite you, really.
But with the same intonation we do.
Oh, definitely.
577.
In the air with me is Lindsay Lonnie and Bonnie Jean Primsch. I'm Lyle Troxell. Now, I've got a little story about Apple and you know, I've been so involved in Google with my Google Glass that I don't pay attention to Apple's very much. But we
poor Apple.
I know. They feel
poor
sad.
Poor neglected
I'm sure.
Apple.
And this is about censorship, kind of. But this is the kind of detailed, geeky, nerdy kind of thing that we do, or I do all the time, in thinking about technology. What kind of social impact do little tiny programming decisions make in our lives? So this is about the spelling correction on your iOS device. So when you've got an iPhone in front of you and you type something, it's very hard to type with just a screen.
Tell me about it.
Yeah. And then if you don't know how to spell all the words you're typing,
I just don't know how
mistakes.
To type them properly.
I know. So Apple does this thing where if you've typed a word that it doesn't have it in its dictionary, it'll underline it in red. Mm-hmm. And then if you click on that word, it might give you a spelling choice, a replacement choice. It's a great way to do this. You type as fast as you want. They look back at it. You see the underlined red words. You click on them and you choose the words you want. So, most recently, a wonderful study took place in which a group did a report and did a research about all the different OS X or Apple's operating system is not open source. Mm-hmm. So you can't actually look at everything they're doing inside the phone. But it looks like there's a giant dictionary in there. And the thing that's interesting is that some words that it knows are spelled correctly, because when you type them correctly, it won't underline them. But if you spell one character off, it will not suggest the word to you. So there's this, this very subtle difference about how the words are being used. And this had to be programmatically done. Because the way you'd normally do this is you'd have a dictionary of all your words. Mm-hmm. And then you, if a word is not in the dictionary and it's relatively close to some of those, you would, when the person, you'd underline it in red because it's not in the dictionary. And then you would give choices that are similar mm-hmm. words. So, for example, one of the words that they're using in the image that I put up on the Geekspeak site is the word abortion. It's spelled incorrectly.
Oh, abortion.
Yeah.
An M.
Yeah, right. Abortion. Yeah. So that's a one character difference. There's no other words that are very close to that in English language or an English set. It underlines it red. When you click on it, it doesn't give you the word abortion as a replacement. So
because it's a sensitive word?
Well, that's the assumption. There's no statement from Apple of why it functions this way. But it looks
they have looked, and there's like
14,000 words.
Oh, 14,000.
Yeah, 13,000 words that show up in the dictionary and that they won't underline them, but will not get a suggestion if you misspell them.
And is there something, I mean, someone has decided that these all look like they're sort of like sensitive topics and they're like
someone's
awkward.
Someone's decided Apple. Now the other, you know, the gun is, or bullet is one of them, for example. Mm-hmm. So they're not, I mean, the sensitivity is based on the receiver, right? It's not by definition, there's no clear understanding of what that is.
Yeah.
But that Apple's making this decision about their technology and then it affects our lives in such a way
right.
as to make it. You know, it does affect us. If I try to type the word abortion and I keep on making a mistake and it keeps on saying underlined red, but I know the word's there, maybe I would rephrase my sentence to call it something else.
Or you're also having to make the conscious act to spell the word. Maybe they're trying to do some sort of like awareness.
I think it's much
like,
more that
dude,
they don't
you use
want...
the word bullet a lot.
Yeah. I don't think it's that. But I definitely think that it very subtly modifies behavior.
Yeah.
And if you read any of the research on how politic works, how you actually, the way you affect change in politic is you get your opponent to use your language. The abortion mm-hmm. versus
don't think of an elephant.
Life. Yeah. But the right to life versus abortion argument, mm-hmm. that the way we phrase it, you use the words that define your
global
argument.
Global warming versus climate change.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So all of these have very high impact on how we think. And if Google, and if Apple's doing this kind of because they don't, you know, they don't want to looked bad upon by anybody. So mm-hmm. they want to be as neutral as possible. Mm-hmm. But in doing this, they're not really being neutral. They're affecting how we
think.
They've
made a choice. They made a conscious choice.
I just think it's kind of interesting.
My curiosity would be, do they decide these things internally or do they go to an external vendor who has a list, keeps a list of these kinds of things? Because there's got to be someone that's doing this out there and someone else that creates their own libraries. I mean, I worked for a security, like a spam, you know, security company for a while, and they kept these kinds of lists of things that were considered offensive or things that, you know, were politically, you know, one way or another.
Uh-huh.
And so big companies could go to those kinds of companies and purchase their lists and, you know, but it, why
and
do you
what
think
were those lists for? Were they for like not wanting to offend anyone or what was the sort of understood purpose?
They were
purpose
used for
of those lists?
Creating a point system for if you were reading a page or getting an email, it would rack up points of how likely it was that it was spam or junk by these kinds of words be existing in the messages. But
because those weren't likely to be in spam or because they were more likely to be in spam?
Because they were more likely to be in spam.
So here's a few people that I respect that have some quotes. And and some thoughts around this topic. And Gillian York of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which we just talked about, says, quote, Apple is one of the most censorious companies out there. It isn't censorship outright, but it's annoying and it's denying choice to customers. So that's her take on it.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like a lot of non-surprise. I'm not surprised Apple does this by any means. But there's an interesting take that I thought I hadn't thought of, which is possibly why they're doing as well. And this is from Boston.com, has a practical take on it. And the argument is it's meant to prevent serious misunderstanding if someone mistypes a word. Maybe that's the reason. Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting concept. If you're typing something and it's kind of close, the word's kind of close to the word abortion, for example, but you're talking about something completely different, if for that word to go into the context of the sentence is really difficult. That all of a sudden modifies the entire context of the sentence. I think Apple doesn't pay attention to that much because I see a lot of mistakes
in
that nature.
Yeah, there's a whole blog about autocorrect gone awry that just makes people weep with laughter because of the misunderstanding.
But maybe they're trying to compensate for that. But it's hard to argue that for the word bullet and stuff. But maybe.
Maybe it's that those are the words that if it is a mistaken correction that people get really ticked off about it.
Right, or it brings in a context that you didn't mean to bring in, or emotionally impact. You know, if you recently went through a horrible shooting tragedy, for example, and I'm chatting with you about going to a ball game, and all of a sudden bullet is in my sentences.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that would hurt you more than if I just have, you know, ball game spelled wrong.
That seems so awfully caretaky of people's sensitive feelings.
Well, maybe they're sensitive about that website that's up about all their misspellings, and they've got their PR in there going, how can we avoid these things?
But, you know, keep in mind that the concept that Apple is very censorship-based is totally right, right? They do not allow any sexual explicit material in their app store, and even when it is very clearly not... that's the thing, is that's always judgment call, right? Mm-hmm. But they, you know, took an app down called Bang with Friends. You can kind of assume what that is, right? Mm-hmm. But that app was removed. There's a mentality about Apple that's, we want to be the mainstream source.
Yeah.
And we don't want to be offensive to anybody.
Extreme
and
based.
In doing that, you really modify, you definitely don't make it friendly to people who are outside maybe the mainstream.
Yeah.
And that's definitely Apple. That's why I'm actually thinking about going to Android. It's one of the reasons. I want more flexibility.
More flexibility.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a list like that for non-English conversation.
I would assume that every language has that. Every language they support. Yeah. Sure. Huh. It's the same concerns exist.
Fantastic.
All right, Lindsay, another story before
we got a phone call, actually.
Oh, well, okay.
Should we take a phone call?
Sure.
From Mardine and Ben Lomond?
Sure.
We'll just take a quick one. All right, let me see if I can do this right here.
All right.
Hey, Mardine, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. What's your question?
Well, I actually have a couple of them. I hope I can get them both.
Let's see how long we have. Go for it.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to record my own ringtone on my iPhone.
Ah.
And I can't figure out how to do that.
All right. Do you have an Apple or a Windows machine at home?
Windows at home.
Oh. Denied. On an Apple environment, now I'll tell you something you don't need to know. On an Apple environment, you can use GarageBand to make ringtones. And GarageBand is an application that comes with, most of the time it comes with the operating system. And you can just take any music you want and mix it in, and then you can say, save as ringtone, and then it will show up in iTunes as a ringtone, and then next time you sync your phone, you can say, I want this to go on my phone. It's like 20 steps, and it's too complicated, but it's really easy. Something like that.
Wait a minute.
If you have a Macintosh.
Now, can she use a friend's Macintosh, or is there a problem there with
the way that syncing works with the phones is that you kind of have to own the phone. It's kind of annoying.
Yeah.
So the other thing to do is there's a lot of apps out there that let you to make ringtones, and that's one way to do it. You can actually buy one of these apps that will allow you to save ringtones and create ringtones. The other thing to do is that, and this is a little more complicated, but a ringtone is actually an MP3 or ALC file. It's an audio file that the phone can understand. And it doesn't have to be short. And then you have to get into iTunes such that iTunes looks at it and goes, this is a ringtone. It means that it's got to have metadata correct and it's got to be put in correctly. This is all modifiable and hackable. And you can do that in a Windows environment. So what this means is you need to get your ringtone into iTunes. That's the trick. And are you syncing your phone with iTunes?
I don't sync my phone at all, actually.
Okay. Apple doesn't need you to do that because they'll take care of all your data in the cloud and you don't have to worry about it. But everybody that has an iPhone, any phone, I highly recommend that you sync it to your own computer. It's the idea of understanding that it's an important part of your information, your data, and therefore you should take responsibility in backing up and maintaining it. So get iTunes downloaded to your Windows machine, plug in your phone, and hope that my advice doesn't cause pain in your life, and sync it.
Yeah, because I've had that happen.
Pain in your life? life because of something Lyle suggested?
Because of sinking.
sinking definitely can cause a bit. Like right now, the other night I'm with my grandmother. She's lost all of her data on her phone, and she's retyping it. I'm like, well, didn't you back it up? Didn't you sync it? And she looks at me like, you jerk. you know how to do this, and you didn't do it for me. I'm like, I'll take care of this right now, Grandma. So I go in the back room and I grab her phone. It's a Windows phone.
It's every geek's responsibility to take care of
the
others.
You've got to do this. This is what
Especially
the holidays
grandma.
Are for. Yeah. So I go to her machine. I start plugging it in, and I try to get, and I realize that the software that Microsoft works for the syncing phone only works on a certain version of OS. So I got to update her OS, and I'm okay. So I try doing that. I've got an OS on me, but she doesn't have RAM in her machine. So I bought the RAM. It's at my house, and next visit, we get syncing happening. So it's not like it's going to be easy, but once it does happen, it's so easy.
It'll be a great ringtone. It'll be a great ringtone, Martin.
Alternatively, I use the voice recorder on my phone to make the file, and then I install an app on my phone that turns that into, but I don't know, I have an Android, so I don't know.
Right. And that's the thing is that the apps on iOS are more restrictive, and they do exist, but yes.
Can you email files from your iPhone to yourself? Or text it?
Yeah. No, you can't send an audio. You can send an audio file to yourself. Yeah, if you recorded that audio file. Yeah.
So email it to yourself, use your computer to.
Yeah, I mean, once you get the audio file on your computer, I mean, the thing is to get the ringtone on the iOS device,
metadata.
You have to have an application do it for you. You can buy an app, an iOS app to do this, or you can have iTunes do it and when they sync. So I would suggest the latter. No, I don't know.
Wait a minute.
Most audio programs will be able to convert the file for you to what format, but
you
iTunes.
You would think.
Oh,
iTunes
Windows,
is, yeah. Well, I just saw that you had a little script on how to do this, right? We have a how to get iTunes to understand a ringtone, which is one of the steps. The other step is to sync your phone to iTunes. I recommend syncing your phone to iTunes just because you start having a responsibility, but you know, it's not technically hard for me, and I know that it can be technically hard. How to make your own ringtone. WikiHow. We will link to it on geekspeak.org.
Now, Martine, you had another question, which I'm keenly interested in because my headsets break all the time, too.
Okay, yeah, that's what it is. I get a headset. I plug it in. I tend to wear it underneath my clothes. You know, I clip it to my, you know, underneath my shirt. And so that all I have coming out is a little wire going to my ear, and, you know, so nobody knows that I'm plugged in. That's I like it. And within 2 or 3 months of getting it and wearing it like that, they break.
Yeah.
Where
and
do they
the
break?
First thing, they, the first thing that happens is that they it, it's, well, usually it's the microphone stops working. But I can still hear people.
Yeah.
Or it'll start making this sound when it's plugged in, only when I'm talking on the phone.
Yeah.
And this is the sound.
That's your clothing being picked up by the mic. The mic in an iPhone cable actually has backward. That's just noise because there's a connection happening.
No, it's coming from a very specific place on the phone.
Yeah.
It's that the little, I guess it's the mic on the phone at the bottom left.
Yeah. Yeah, it's basically the mic is no longer functioning. The phone's not detecting the mic, so it turns on its other mic. So the way that the phone is working is that it's actually doing a lot of detection of the system. So if you plug in, for example, a headphone that doesn't have, like a normal headphones we're wearing right now, that doesn't have a mic in it, the iPhone will still have the mic on the bottom of the phone. You can use it that way. So you can plug in a normal pair of headphones at the top and then talk in the bottom of the phone like a little, like a radio broadcaster, right, holding your hand, which I do sometimes when my mics break. Now, one of the things that I've gathered over time is that the $30 headphones from Apple last about 3 months.
Okay.
Wow.
And that's because I do chainsaw work while having these in. I do a lot of crazy stuff with these.
$10 a month.
Yeah. But the thing is, they're about $10 a month. I mean, what I finally decided is, I'm going to be okay with this. So I had to stop getting angry. I have
for it.
Now, I have an electronics degree, right? So I have a lot of old, broken iPhone headsets.
What are you going to do with them all,
I sometimes solder them and fix
them.
It's
going to be a
sometimes
bracket.
I take, like, this mic works, but this left ear doesn't work, and I rewire them and solder them. And it's I don't recommend it. They're really small wires.
Yeah.
The other trick is what's happening is the probably moisture and lotions and things of that nature are getting into the device. So you want to minimize that. The other thing is that when you take them off and you don't have them, do you stick them in your pocket or you just kind of hang them from the front of your shirt?
I usually put them in the bathroom on the back of the toilet.
Okay.
Coil them up gently and put them there.
Yeah, so you take good care of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when you're wearing them, you know, you want to think about what kind of material is getting them. Like if it's close to your skin, if you're in your shirt and you've worn some kind of like sunscreen or something and that stuff gets in there, it can be kind of corrosive. So there's partially that, but I think it's really, they make them really light and small and over time they get physical damage.
Mm.
And I got to say that when you hit one with a chainsaw, they do not survive.
They don't like that.
No.
Yeah. Avoid the chainsaws, Martine.
Yeah. But the other thing, the tucking out of the clothes. The tucking out of the clothes is a really good idea. I don't do it very much, but it's a good idea because you don't catch the doorknob while you're walking down the hall that way.
Right.
And then you get yanked out of your ear.
That's what happens to me.
Yeah.
I was thinking that was the best way to protect it, to keep it under your clothes where it's not getting snagged.
There's some crazy body modifications you can do if you want. You can
just plug them in directly.
You can get little magnets. Yeah. You can get little magnets cut into your ear and put in your ear, and then you can wear a circle of cable around your neck, and then your ears will vibrate by the magnetic flow of the cable.
We covered that. A dude did that.
I recommend not doing that.
Don't, not. It's elaborate.
Sounds cool.
I would be curious to know if these $30 headphones compare to the $5 headphones and with longevity.
I don't know about longevity, but quality. I mean, I am so amazed when I take a cheap pair of headphones and I'm wearing it and get used to it and listen to podcasts, even a talk podcast, right? I'm like listening or some music. And then I put in the Apple ones. They are so much better. The quality is amazing.
That's good to hear.
I mean, when in the first month. The third month.
Yeah.
Actually, the most recent one I've kept for a longer period of time. For now, for me, it's about how I treat them and see how long I can keep them going.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Martine, thanks for calling.
Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
We have another call. We have Barb from Santa Cruz. And Barb, we'll get to you in just a second. But let's go ahead and, Lindsay, let's cover another news story.
Okay, sure.
Oh, and you know what? Before we do that, we really should say this is KUSP. This is Geek Speak. Everything we talk about on Geek Speak is up at geekspeak.org. In the air with me is Bonnie Jean Primsch, Lindsay Lonnie, and I'm Lyle Troxell.
So I've got another story. First, I'll just tell you something that's related to what you were talking about earlier with the spelling, Lyle. Kickstarter campaign is underway to fund a prototype smart pen that checks your spelling as you write. It's called the Lernstift, which is German for learning pen.
I read up on this when you were providing it earlier today, and I didn't get it.
Yeah.
I didn't get it.
That's why it's a geek bit, because, I don't know if I need a pen that checks my spelling, but what happened was this engineer's wife was complaining that she was having trouble with their son's homework because as he would write, he would misspell and then they would have to go back and erase things and correct them. Mm-hmm. And she said it would be so useful to him if there was some indicator as he wrote that the pen could tell him that he misspelled something. And
so it's just like a little
buzzer.
It vibrates. Cool. It vibrates.
So this pen that has two functions. One is calligraphy mode, which helps you correct individual letters, and orthography mode, which vibrates when a word is misspelled.
There's no way this works.
It's a Kickstarter campaign.
Okay,
there's a prototype.
There's a prototype.
If you believe enough, you can pay for it.
If you believe enough,
there is a prototype.
Kickstarter.
Right.
The new logo. Belief is futile.
But if it vibrates once it's detected that he's already misspelled a word wrong, he still has to go back and erase and correct.
But he knows right then. Instant feedback is such a better way to train.
Oh, it's
right?
Better training tool.
Yeah. Train?
Yeah, so then you
kids?
Remember. And teach. Then it doesn't take one later when mom is looking at the homework to then have to go back and do the homework over again.
He still has to figure out what the right spelling is.
Exactly. Well, it's awesome. Battery-powered Linux computer, and it contains instruments to calculate the 3D movements. So it has a gyroscope, it has an accelerometer, and a magnetometer, which measures the length and direction of magnetic fields.
That seems so elaborate. Yeah. You know what it needs is a little, like that speak and spell voice to say the correct spelling is
A-N-G-E-L. I like you have to look it up. I think that's great.
It has Wi-Fi integration, so you could integrate it with your phone, and someone could write an app that would do something like that for you.
Well, there you go. There's somebody's next million.
Right.
Before we take that call, I just want to mention, speaking of millions, I can't believe this. Microsoft stock value dipped.
What?
By $32 billion.
Oh, that's a lot of money.
Which normally that's like all the monies.
All the monies.
When you say $32 billion, you go, oh, there's a country, right?
Yeah.
But yeah,
right.
Microsoft, and they're still fine. Yeah. I mean, it's bad if you're invested in Microsoft, of course. That's not good. But
you're crying today.
Yeah. But they're fine. All right, let's take a call. Let's go ahead and go to Barb Santa Cruz. Hi, Barb. Welcome to Geek Speak.
Barb, you there? Oh, I think I just locked her.
Oh, we just locked. No, that's okay. Locked is good. You're on one or two.
I'm on two.
Oh, Barb, you should be there.
You know,
why don't you put the other slider up, the phone slider that says phone. Is that the
right? Look at all those shiny buttons.
That's the one.
Hello.
Hi, Barb. What's your question?
Okay. Hi.
Hi, what's your question today?
I was away for quite a while, and I came home to find that my router is missing its ID number and its password, and it's unlocked.
That's disturbing.
That's not good.
Yeah.
What do you mean it's unlocked? You mean the Wi-Fi stuff changed on your router?
Now when I go to hook up to
Wi-Fi in the house. It just says Linksys, and it's the only thing around the neighborhood that's unlocked.
Did you have a power outage while you were gone?
I couldn't tell you.
Okay.
Can I smoke?
Yeah, but that shouldn't have changed it unless it got...
But I don't think
reset to default.
Well, let me ask you. You said neighborhood. Describe your neighborhood. not like it's where you are, but like how many houses are near you?
I want to know where you are so I can use your Wi-Fi.
A number of houses are near you? Free Wi-Fi, everybody. Santa Cruz. No, that's not why I'm asking. The reason I'm asking is that it's very likely, it's very possible that your router is dead. And the router you're seeing that you're connecting to and trying to work on is one of your neighbors.
I think it's the only strongest one around.
Okay,
you know,
so do yourself
my neighbors that do have it.
Yeah.
And
so you can confirm this, of course, by unplugging the router and seeing if that connection goes away. Okay. All right, so the question is, why did it reset? It is possible that someone snuck in your house and pushed a little button for 12 seconds. It's also possible that the machine reset itself because of some error that occurred. It could do that. I'd highly recommend
that be a bug.
Yeah. The thing is, it should be working for you. It's just open, right?
Yes, yeah. It is working, but I want to go in and...
Did you have anybody visiting your house while you were gone?
Taking care of the cats.
House. I'm in a shared household.
Yeah, I'm the kind of person, in my youth, in my 20s or so, I might have been at a house and couldn't get on the Wi-Fi and asked around and then reset it so I could. I think that you probably had a annoying geek visit. And reset your power. Because all you do is hold down that reset button. You power it off. You plug it back in. While it's plugging in, you hold down this little reset button with a pen in the back, and it will set to factory defaults. So go ahead and go through the process. You're going to find a lot of details on how to do this at Linksys' site. There's lots of recommendations. Just follow one of those recommendations and do it. Make sure you write down with a pen, a spell-correcting pen, the data that you put in so you keep it. But other than that, it's probably someone physically did that. That's the most likely in my mind.
Was that your question, Barb,
I called their support, and they said, well, it's going to cost you to get support. You might as well just buy a new one.
Was it working?
Yeah, it's working now.
You don't need to do any support. All you have to do is go online, if it's working in that level. It probably is. Go online, look for setting up Linksys router, and then follow those directions. And in fact, the process is pretty simple. You're getting an IP address when you connect to the Linksys router. And that IP address, in the details of where that IP address is in your computer, and I'm not going to go into the details right now on how that works.
Right.
There's going to be a router IP. If you go to that router IP, you're going to be able to access your router, and the username is going to be admin. The password is going to be something like blank or 12345, or it's going to be on the bottom of the machine. And then you type that in, and then you have like a web interface to manage your router. It's really easy to do. You just need to have those little details about that data. And you can find that by looking at your model number and setup instructions. Good luck, Barb. Thanks for calling GeekSpeak.
All right.
Bye-bye.
We wanted to get into another news story or two. So, Lindsay, go ahead. Tell us.
Sure.
Do tell us about rocket engines, please.
Rocket engines.
Who doesn't love rocket engines? Thanks for the sound effects.
I'm helpful. Yeah.
So it has been confirmed that the F1 rocket engine that was salvaged by Amazon's Jeff Bezos's excavation team, or whatever you call it. I don't know if excavation is the right word, but they go deep, deep underwater and pull things off the ocean floor.
Mm-hmm.
That this rocket is actually from the Apollo 11 mission, which I believe today is the 44th anniversary of the first moon landing, but I'd have to verify that. I'm pretty sure. The folks over there confirmed that the serial number they found 3 miles below on this thing, 3 miles below the ocean surface, matched the number of the F1 engine. Before, they knew that it was one of the Apollo mission engines, but they didn't know it was the actual, moon, the big Apollo 11 mission one.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's been confirmed. That was still the largest rocket engine that was ever used. NASA's got plans to maybe make a bigger one in the future, but that was the big one.
That was it.
Yeah.
Awesome. We have another geek bit online, and that is just this wonderful picture of a woolly mammoth. And
that looks disgusting.
It's disgusting, but basically this 39,000-year-old mummified woolly mammoth, it's the best-preserved mammoth in the history of paleontology. It goes on show in Japan. There's amazing pictures of it. You said deflated mammoth.
It looks like a deflated mammoth. Yeah.
It's quite possible that there's enough material on this thing to clone it. So this is that, we might bring the woolly mammoth back by cloning it and impregnating a traditional elephant.
What will we do with it once we have it again?
Feed it grass.
Put it in a zoo.
Ask it what it's like to be deceased species. Jane from Santa Cruz is on, and you got a question about videos and streaming, and we have a few minutes, so go for it.
Oh, we do not have Jane.
Okay.
No, Jane.
Nope, not there.
Oh, well. So push those buttons again to unlock them.
Okay.
There you go.
There we go.
I don't know.
All right.
Well, we won't take Jane's call, which is fine.
Sorry,
we've
Jane.
Got tons of other information to talk about. Lindsay, one more story before we end for the day.
Okay. Can I do another geek bit one?
I'd
that's
love
kind
it.
Of silly.
Please. We have all these today's show you have to see to believe.
It's totally a visual show.
Radio.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a cell phone that is powered by urine. And
oh, fun.
Finally.
Yeah,
it's a
just
phone
what you always
for,
wanted.
Who's the guy? Bear Grylls? Who's the one that drinks? And the survival.
I don't want to know. Oh, okay.
The survivor dude.
It's not conveniently portable yet, this pack, but it consists of 6 4-inch long ceramic cylinders.
I'm glad they're
and
still
a network
work
of 25
it.
Smaller fuel cells borrowed from this waste-fueled EcoBot. And
cool.
After 24 hours of charging, a Samsung phone stayed alive for 25 minutes, where you could send texts and make a 6-minute, 20-second call.
Wait. You charged it for how long?
24 hours.
This is like if your arm's caught under the rock and you don't want to have to chew it off yet.
Exactly.
You could just
in that
pee
specific
first.
Situation, wait. If I can pee, then in 24 hours, I'll be able to make a 20-second call.
6 minutes.
6 minutes. Okay.
That's
I'm sorry.
Plenty.
I thought it was 20 seconds because 20 seconds would be just enough to get across the information that.
Well, can you get it on the phone? Yes, I can hold for a little while.
No, but then how are you making this call? I can't describe this to you in enough time. All right. Twitter creator suggests, one of the Twitter creators, this is Biz Stone, thinks he has a brilliant idea for Facebook, which I think is wonderful, right?
To just stop
already? Stop. He basically says, look, the ads are annoying me. I like Facebook. Yeah. Will you please let us pay to turn the ads off? It's one of those things all
right.
of us have asked.
Subscription service.
This is just a big one asking. I thought it was kind of an interesting story, a good photo of it. And we are running out of Geek Speak. This is the end of the show. Today on Geek Speak was Bonnie Jean Premsch. I'm Lyle Troxell. And Lindsay Lonnie was here as well.